Okay, good morning, everybody. We're back at Sefer Yeshua, and we left off towards the end of Perek Zion, and we were on end of Pasuk Chof Aleph. So we're still left with some major questions that have to be dealt with. The main question of all the questions, although we gave a partial answer to it, but why did Achan do his sin? So far we've been saying it's been greed and a desire for money, but this, you know, the fact that such tragic events happened from this, you know, has to be more than this. And the fact that we've already said he sinned before, he sinned twice during Moshe's time. Really, more we'll see, but and Chazal say he violated all five books of the Torah. There's a Medrash that says that from all the Gams, from the five Gams. Also, the Medrash, it's really Gemara in Sanhedrin. It also says he tried to conceal his bris. It also says he raped a betrothed woman. So it's a pretty rotten guy over here. And there's all kinds of issues. So,
because
he wasn't caught. Anyway, so we already said that Sefer Yeshua is a permanent Sefer. It and the five books of Moses are there forever, and not only because it talks about the distribution of the land of Israel, but also the roots of our possession of the land and the whole framework of how we possess the land, our inalienable right to the land, what enables us to retain the land. That's all critical things. But there's one more thing that the Sefer does have to tell us as well, that it also shows us the ultimate seeds of the sinful behavior that would twice drive us out of the land of Eretz Yisrael. So there's got to be something to that found in this Sefer as well. And although we already explained the whole idea of Kol Yisrael or Eben Zebazet, and every Jew is mixed up with every other Jew, and therefore we benefit from the greatness of every Jew, and unfortunately we also lose out a lot from the fact that not every Jew is up to the level they're supposed to be at. So Rav Kook explains the idea and why we learned in the Chazals that say only when we entered Eretz Yisrael did this responsibility take its full meaning on. So he says that in the land of Eretz Yisrael, Achdus is this idea of unity, and Kol Yisrael Arim Zozeh is a literal concept. In other words, it really comes alive as opposed to in Golos. He says when we're in Eretz Yisrael, what we call this collective national soul is totally alive, and our common destiny is felt in a most intense way, as this analogy of, we said, of, let's say, the unified body, where it's all one body, and if anything is wrong, the whole body suffers from this. But only in Eretz Yisrael can the real Arevus actually take place. The idea that every Jew has to be responsible for another, that feeling can exist in the Golos on some level, but to be experienced fullest, in the fullest sense, is only in Eretz Yisrael. And because when we're out of Golos, we can't really experience nationhood, really can't take control of our destinies in the way we'd like to. But in Eretz Yisrael, we have that potential of being a whole unit, and therefore we can have this collective responsibility, and therefore if Yidden make a mistake, we have to be responsible for it. And so we have to see exactly what's the issue over here. And this really, and as well we see, especially in Eretz Yisrael, here's the main point, that the individual personality of a Jew is nullified to a great extent and is superseded by his share of the national identity. In other words, the human individuality is curbed significantly when you're in Eretz Yisrael, and that person has to focus more on his national identity, much more than his individual identity. That is what Eretz Yisrael is all about. That's why in the Vidui, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we always say, Ashamnu Bagadnu, in the plural sense. It's not I, we sinned, we committed these sins before you. Even if the particular Jew saying the Vidui didn't do that sin, invariably some other Jew did. And we have to focus on every Jew. And the main point of this Kol Yisrael, Arevim Zevazel, that happens in Eretz Yisrael, means as much as, certainly I am an individual to a certain extent, and I have to take responsibility for myself, but it is far more overshadowed by the national identity that I have to feel. I have to feel, mamish, that the most important thing is my national identity. And that is so critical. And this was Achan's fundamental error. That a Jew cannot be an individualist who distances himself from the community and locks himself up within his own Dalaramis, his own little world of his own. And the Jewish life of every individual Jew has such a profound public dimension to it, and that you're so bound up in that community, and that there really is no such thing as a private Jew. And certainly, regarding the land of Eretz Yisrael, every Jew is gripped by the holiness of the place, and you're totally bound to that place and to that group of people who are taking this land of Eretz Yisrael, right? And this can only be really sensed in Eretz Yisrael and not in the Golos. And therefore, Achan's sin really went against this principle. The principle of having a national, feeling a national identity, the individual feeling being part of the nation. And what Achan said was the opposite, that a Jew can have an individual identity and an individual averus. And what one Jew does not necessarily affect other Jews. And that was the fatal mistake that he made. He denied this concept of collective responsibility. And that really is the essential attachment that we have to this land of Eretz Yisrael. And such an approach to life that Achan had, Yoshua had to totally repudiate that. He had to totally knock that down. That was a critical thing, and that was really what was going on over here. In other words, there's two ways of looking at things. I look out, I do what I want to do my own thing, or no, there's no such thing as doing your own thing. I mean, there only is doing your own thing within the context of being part of the nation, and you can't do your own thing. There is no, especially in Eretz Yisrael, there's no such thing as doing your own thing. We're all part of one collective unit, and we have to take care of each other. As we went through Rav Dessler's piece, that whole idea that if a person does an avera, that means he feels not part of the group. You feel that you don't have anything to do with that group, and the group has a responsibility to make everybody feel that they are part of a group, and they can't feel that they are their own individuals, and there are certain limits to the individual autonomy that any Jew has. And therefore the community has to pay a price even if one Jew fails. That is what has to be so critically understood, that Hashem needed them to understand how important this was. And therefore there wasn't room to let this one go, as it were. And even the head of the Sanhedrin would have to die to show you how critically important that this concept is, that there is no such thing as an individual Jew. An individual Jew, to the exclusion of the community, cannot exist. And Achan certainly thought that it could. And when Ochran's name, for example, emerges as the guilty party in the lottery. So the Gemara tells us, really it's the Medrash. The Medrash says that, what was Ochran saying? He says, listen, I'm trapped. So what am I going to do? I'm going to be totally embarrassed. He says, I better deny the validity of the lottery system and let Yeshua think that I'm a liar, but the other Jews will think that I'm not a criminal. And that's why he responded and said, well, you drew lots on me. What if you didn't draw lots between yourself and Pinchas? It would have come out on somebody. So he denied this idea of the lottery. Even that whole idea of the lottery shows the Achdus. How every Jew, you know, is part of one group, and we'll have to single out the evil Jew and get rid of that evil Jew because he can't affect. In other words, how can we know what an individual's doing? So the lottery's going to have to tell us this. So that there's no such thing as hiding even the individual Jew. No such thing as hiding the individual Jew. He's part of that group. So, so what did Yeshua say? He says, listen, you know, please give honor to Hashem. Please confess. Please tell him what you've done. Don't hold anything back. So how does Achan's complaint, which would seemingly on the surface be valid, you know, how did Yeshua really answer it? And and of course, you know, how did Yeshua really refute Achan's arguments? He says, listen, what does it prove? And more importantly, we see that at the same time, when Yeshua challenges what really Achan is doing, he's challenging Yeshua's authority. That's what he's doing. He's challenging his authority. And all of a sudden, the Jewish people start to split into warring factions, as we said, that the tribe of Yehuda arises and is either they're either killing or about to kill, depending on the Medrash that you're learning. And only then did Achan say, well, you know, it's better, you know, whoever saves one life is like you saved the whole world. I better stop this from going on over there. Then he fully confesses. So what ultimately prompted him to confess? So he cared more about others than himself. It didn't seem that way. So where did he generate all this concern for the community of the Jewish people all of a sudden? So, also, as we said, he said, you know, don't think that I took all the wealth because I was poor. The truth is, I'm the richest guy here. So then again, so why did he take it? So then what was really going on over here? What was the deeper idea over here? So this is the answer. When Achan attacked the validity of the lottery system and the fact that Yeshua suggested there was Hashkacha Pratis, divine providence masked, you know, that was in this. What he really was doing, what Achan was really doing, he was going against Yeshua's authority. And what was really going on, and that's where you see a lot of similarities between what happened with Achan, what happened with Korach, is that this was a subtle but still strong rebellion against Yehoshua. And where Moshe had similar threats from Korach, Yehoshua got the threat even quicker. By Moshe, it took over a year till they went against him. But here it took maybe like a month. The first month there was a little bit of a rebellion. And how is this happening over here? So, and Achan took similar idea as Korach did. And he denies this lottery. And he says like this, for example, and here's like a critical point. He says, listen, I looked in the Torah, and the Torah says that when you destroy a city, you get all the shalal. You get all the loot. And you may take this. So the Torah says we're allowed to take the spoils. And you went on your own, and you made a cheirim on this. And you are distorting what the Torah is saying. You know, and there was a very similar with Korach. Korach said, whatever Hashem says, I'll listen to. But you're going to say something? I can't agree to that. It says in the five books of Moses, I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to argue if you have to keep Shabbos. But you are making up halachas that I'm not going to agree to. And Achan is saying the same thing. I say what it says in the Torah. You went and decided to make everything a cheirim. Who gives you the right to do such a thing? And therefore, every time when he took the loot from other wars. It was the same idea. Who's Moshe to say that we can't take, that we shouldn't have taken from other things? So we really are allowed to take the spoils. And you are distorting the Torah. Obviously, Yeshua, you're doing it for personal reasons. What's the personal reasons over here? Well, after all, we know Yeshua is a descendant from Yosef. Descendant from Yosef. Yosef in the brachos of Yaakov, right? He's called the Nazir Echov, the Nazir, the one who's the most abstinent, the one who's more machmer on himself. A Nazir doesn't allow himself all certain pleasures, right? You're a really holy guy. You abstain, you refrain from excessive pleasures. So you are doing like your name, like from your lineage, you put all these chumras on us. These chumras, these stringencies on us. So what he's saying is, I didn't take the spoils because I needed them, right? But to prove my point, that Yeshua, you're corrupting the Torah with all your chumras. You're making Yiddishkeit intolerable. You're telling us we can't eat lettuce because there's bugs in them, right? And who are you to make life so difficult on the Jewish people? So, you know, as they say, it's not the money, it's the principle of the thing. Right? And that was the principle going on. Because he's saying, I'm rich, but I didn't need it. If you don't need it, why are you taking it for? Just to prove the point. The point is, who are you to be so machmer on Klal Yisrael? We don't want this to be a black hat community. You know, who tells us we have to have a hat and a jacket for davening? That's all chumras. You know, and you're gonna take away everything that Yiddishkeit's all about. So his grievance focused on two different areas and was drawing supporters. Right? And that's the point. The tribe of Yehuda was ready to fight a war to support these principles. Yeshua was challenged, number one, as a religious authority. And who are you to make up these halachas over here? And number two, that they're saying you seem to be wanting to take the power of king. And that tramples on the rights of Yehuda, because Yehuda is destined to be the royal house of the Jewish people. The kings are supposed to come from Yehuda. And who are you from Yosef? And there was always that, as we'll see, always that tension between the descendants of Yehuda and the descendants of Yosef. Always that tension, the Bechor from Rachel, the Bechor from Leah. Who's supposed to be the leader? That was on when the brothers were around. It was always, you know, formal. And we'll see, it'll come back later on in this Sefer, at the end of Sefer Yeshua as well. We'll see it comes back. And certainly everybody was you know, what's going on? Hashem said Yeshua is the next leader. He told Moshe to be smich on Yeshua. Who's going to argue that Yeshua is the leader? So what's going on? So they were happy to allow Yeshua to lead them into the land. Okay, somebody's got to lead us into the land, and Moshe tells them he's going to lead them into the land. That's okay. You want to fight the wars for us? That's what Hashem says. We're not going to argue on that. Chas v'shalom, we can't argue. That's what Hashem says. But we're not ready to give up our royal rights and the things that really belong to Yehuda in the long run, and to let Yeshua rule as a monarch. And to the extent that he can have executed one of our tribesmen, you know, now you're already using royal powers over here. And what Achan was restating really were the arguments of the spies against Moshe's authority and those of were Moshe's leadership authority. And Korach, who argued Moshe's spiritual authority, there's two different authorities going on over here that Moshe had and that Yeshua is taking over as well. And they're basically saying, who are you to change the rules? And who appointed you all together to be this person, to take it on to such an extent? And the fact that this is after a defeat in battle doesn't hurt their arguments. All right. That was kind of also with Moshe Rabbeinu, like after the sin of the spies and after the Jews aren't going into Eretz Yisrael and people aren't allowed, that's when Korach hit Moshe at a weak point. And Yeshua is at a very weak point now. The Jews are totally in shock. And he's saying, of course we're in trouble. Because who told you to be so machmer? Who told you to make such stringencies over here? You know, and they remember, nobody knows the real reason yet. The real reason. something's there. Well, it said it was Achan's fault. It says, what do you mean it's my fault? It was my fault. I didn't do anything wrong. But you should, this whole lottery system is a sham. The whole thing is a sham. And again, it, wouldn't it be hard to understand how could such a holy man like Yorban and Menashe die just because one guy did an Avera? I mean, you know, Moshe told them this was going to happen when they came into Israel. There'd be this collective responsibility. But nobody really, you know, kind of internalized that. And all they're internalizing is a dead soldier in battle. You know, that whole idea, you know, you go to war and it's a moral war. And you really have good reasons to go. But also when the deaths start piling up, all of a sudden the morality starts to diminish. And let's just pull out and cut our losses. Even though it might be a morally principled war, but you know, who wants people to die and all these things? And that's, you know, that's where all these, you know, peace nicks, you know, have support, because who wants to die? And there is a emotional connection to that attitude. While on the other hand, but realistically it's not. Realistically it can't be such a thing. So he caught the people were in a vulnerable time. And he says, well, you know, if anything, I can further, in other words, this was a beef that Achan had for a long time. You know, who is Moshe Rabbeinu to be the leader? He's not from the Shevet Yehuda. So he constantly would always take and would always sin because he was always philosophically opposed to this idea. And obviously, Achan himself was filled with grandiose ideas of course, him being the king. Why shouldn't he be that? He's from Yehuda, and he must have been a very, very big spiritual man. He must have been. You know. And, if for what he said, the tribe of Yehuda is like taking up his cause, he couldn't have been just a schmo. So Achan probably had ideas of, you know, he's appealing to these people as an ideologue. Like, you know, the guy with the great idea, the great philosophy. And that the power should be in Shevet Yehuda and not with Yeshua, who comes from the youngest tribes. Right? And you see what kind of tyrant Yeshua is? And I have to self-sacrifice. Somebody has to stand up to him. And I will stand up to him. Because everybody else is afraid to stand up to him. And that every Jew, and what really he was saying, and is no different than what Korach was saying, but now it's much more real because we're coming into Eretz Yisrael. He proposed that every Jew, you know, has a democratic right over here. Has a democratic right. And there's nothing as attractive to people as democracy. You know, it's we can make all the decisions over here. And it shouldn't be invested in a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So that really was he was beginning the seeds of a total rebellion against Yeshua. Okay. So now, you had a question?
Yeah. So Achan wasn't just an individual simple Jew who just stole and that was the whole problem. He was the exponent of a whole movement that was going on.
Well, I don't know if it was a whole movement, but it might have been
he had his chutzpah to.
Well, yeah, it's an idea. It was an idea, and that maybe was lying dormant. You know, maybe people thought about it, but didn't have the chutzpah to act on it. Yeah, so he is trying to start as a subtle rebellion, but now that the lottery fell out on him, now push comes to shove, so now he has to go full blown against. And it's hard to believe that nobody didn't know about this.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he must have been telling people, you know, you don't just take for yourself without telling some people, at least within your tribe.
He must have been an agitator.
Saying, you know, I don't believe in this Narish guy. I'm going to take. What right does he have to tell us? This is not a mitzvah. And he must have told other people in Yehuda about it. And could be people in other Yehuda knew about it and didn't say anything. I don't know. Are they going to report on him? They're going to, you know. Because after all, they kind of felt maybe he's right. Maybe he's right. Who says that Yeshua has this right to do this? So this was a critical test that he was showing against Yeshua. So now Hashem did bless Yeshua. He says, "Rech chazak v'amatz." You have to be strong, and if you're strong, you'll be able to withstand all these tests against your authority. So how did he respond? So first of all, if you know, he says, Bini, my son. Right. This is first of all, he says, listen, my son, we're one family. All right. There's a family issue over here. It's not, let's try to make this a political issue. He says, and give honor to Hashem and confess to him and tell me what you've done. Right? Don't hold anything back from me. And then as the Medrash speaks out, as we spoke, he says, and also, don't knock the integrity of this lottery system. Because this lottery system is going to be the way that's going to divide the land of Israel amongst the tribes. Right? At the very least, at least admit that this system is a reliable system. Because how else are we going to give out this land? How are we going to give this land out amongst all the Jews? If people lose faith in the lottery system, we're never going to live in this land. How can we decide who should live and where should live? Who could ever decide such a thing? So this was really a brilliant political maneuver on his part. Because by throwing everything, it's all relying on the authority of the lottery system. He says, look, the lottery benefits everybody. Everybody will gain from this lottery system. And therefore, he was hoping that people would hear this idea. They say, yeah, how am I going to know what kind of peace law I'm going to, how are we going to decide this? So if they're going to understand that they need to accept the lottery in terms of the division of the land, then they'll have to accept the validity of the lottery in determining the fate of this one person. So in one swift movement, Yeshua validated the lottery as the most impartial means of dividing up the land, and therefore depriving Achan of his following and his very compelling argument. Because at the end of the day, everybody does care about where their piece of land comes. At the end of the day, ideologies fall if you benefit against the ideology. At the end of the day, any common sense person, yeah, how are we going to decide? It's going to be impossible. You got 600,000 who are going to fight it out amongst themselves. Who's going to get the best pieces of land?
Up to that point, they didn't know about this sort of thing.
They didn't know how it was going to be given out yet. Didn't know it was going to be given out yet. And that was going to, and that, you know, and they're probably figuring, yeah, what's going to be? Yeshua's going to decide, who's he to decide, who's going to get what and what, and the, you know, and all the political maneuvering that happens in terms of giving out favors and things like that. Right? So now, yeah?
But why would they think that a lottery would work to their individual benefit?
Because there's no other way it's impartial.
But it's
very impartial and you can't argue with it. You can't argue with it. It's the only way you can do it. It makes sense. How else are you going to decide who gets what? How else are you going to decide it?
Well, through cunning and guile.
Yeah. Okay. But then you're looking to destroy the whole people. You're looking to destroy everybody. Right. That means everyone's going to be cunning and guiling to everybody. You know, there's no way. There's no way that doesn't just seem to make sense. And they know there is HaKadosh Baruch Hu here. I mean, they do know there is HaKadosh Baruch Hu here, right? And if Yeshua is saying HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving it out, okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu probably knows what's best. We are a people of God, after all. Right? We do believe in a God. Right? We do believe in a God. And he says, this is the way we're going to... So if it was Yeshua just saying, well, it's to determine who stole. Well, he could say, maybe it's not. Maybe God didn't want that too. But on the other hand, he says, this is how we're going to divide up the land of Eretz Yisrael. And Hashem did promise us the land of Eretz Yisrael. And Hashem, you know, up to this point is going to help us get the land of Eretz Yisrael. So it makes sense that Hashem should decide who gets the land. And the only way Hashem could decide who gets the land is through a Goral. So now, at this point, this is like the knockout punch. So Achan realized that if the people do accept the Goral, and they must, regarding the allocation of the land of Israel, so they got to accept the conclusions regarding his fate as well, that the Goral has determined that as well. And by Yeshua showing that the Goral is the most legitimized system to use, and now he shows you that, you know, Hashem is involved in our affairs again. So again, like when Korach rebelled, so Hashem, you know, confirmed Moshe's authority by swallowing up Korach. So Yeshua, thank God, did not have to come on to swallowing up Achan, although probably Hashem would have helped him if need be. But Yeshua accomplished the same goal by persuading Achan to validate the Goral that would reveal the will of Hashem over here. So really, Achan, He played out his political hand, and Yeshua's hand was stronger. It was stronger, you know. Until Yeshua came up with, well, that's how we're going to divide up the whole land. You know, then that kind of just muted whatever Achan could muster against the Jewish people. So then Achan had to authenticate the lottery system. And then once he had to, then Yeshua said, okay, now tell me that you did it. Tell me what you really did. And he really couldn't argue this, because this was a public the lottery was a public demonstration. Either you're going against the lottery, or you have to agree to the lottery. So he had to agree to the lottery. So now, at that point, Achan is exposed not as a guy who so much cares about, love of Torah and love of the Jewish people, but really he's just a scoundrel who did a lot of crimes, because at the end of the day, it was because of greed and arrogance and because of contempt for Torah. And he was exposed. And just like Korach, Achan's grievances were really very personal and very petty and not so philosophical. And like it says, he stole a Babylonian garment. This was the cloak of a king of Bavel, as the Medrash says, which was taken from a king's summer home in Yericho. Right? So obviously this showed his desiring for the throne of Israel as well. You know why he took a royal garment, because I'll wear this royal garment, I must be a chashiva guy. Right? And so Achan sought this power. And the path to his power was paved with arrogance, the arrogance of a separatist. And he feels the rules that govern the lives of all men did not apply to him, especially, and the truth is, especially the laws of Torah didn't apply to him. Really, at the end of the day, nothing applied to him. And therefore, Chazal understood that he must have done a host of sins violating the Torah. Because once you're excluding yourself from the group that unanimously kept the Torah at Sinai, so really what you're really saying is, I want the religion to be the way I think the religion should be. And that's the way it is with all people. Therefore, the Chazal said he hid his circumcision. He kind of made it that there was no circumcision because he didn't identify himself with the Jewish people. And this is after the mass circumcision. Right? And he ravishes a young bride. Mean to say, I have the right to take anything I want, right? And that's what he did. So he was like a free thinker, and he advocated this individual autonomy that people have, and I'm not bound by the Torah system. And really, when you do that and you have that kind of autonomy, then you're really repudiating your membership from the Jewish people, and that's what you're doing. And the biggest mark of a Jew is your milah. It's your circumcision, and I don't have any allegiance really to the Jewish people. That's what really came out at the end. It came out in democracy for everybody's rights, but at the end of the day, it really was not for anybody. Right? And then you have a feeling of entitlement, and no pleasure can be denied for you. And the greatest act of selfishness and chutzpah is to rape an engaged woman who's supposed to go for somebody else, and I'm gonna take it away from her. So that really showed the real crookedness that lied within this person, right? And on the other hand, look at the difference between how he acts and how Yeshua acts. When there's a loss in the battle and a Jew gets killed in eye because of the sins of others, but Yeshua took personal responsibility for it, right? He didn't make a commission. He didn't make an investigation. He didn't try to find who to put the blame on right away. He falls before Hashem, he rips his garment, he puts the ashes on his head, and he realizes, no, I'm not going to look for any scapegoats, it's my fault, I have to take responsibility for it, and I have to deal with it. Right? And therefore as well, the Sanhedrin had to take responsibility, and that's why Yoreb and Menashe had to died, because there was a certain responsibility that they had to take as well. So it's interesting that initially Achan would have used the death of Yor to reinforce his heretical, self-centered beliefs. He says, if even a righteous guy like Yor can die in battle, then there's no guarantees in life, and therefore do whatever you can. If even a tzaddik dies, so, you know, what does it pay to be a tzaddik? Better be on your own. Right? So, and that was really, the whole problem was these royal ambitions that he had. And that's why, if you notice, when the Navi goes through and goes through all the his forefathers, right? It says it was Achan ben Carmi ben Zavdi ben Zerach Lamata Yehuda. It was the son of Zerach. And twice the Navi writes this. It is an ancestor of Zerach. Now, what do we know about Zerach? Right? Zerach was one of Yehuda, when he was with Tamar, she got pregnant. She had twins. Peretz and Zerach and Peretz. And as you know the story is that first, as she was giving birth, first one child sticks his hand out. They put the red thread around him, and then what happened afterwards? The other one jumped ahead and got out. Right, already mentioned that with the story of Rachav. So they named the first one Zerach because of the scarlet thread that kind of shined, whatever. But the other one was Peretz because he broke through and took being the Bechor. And everything that goes on with being the Bechor, the Kedusha and the holiness and everything that has to do with doing a Bechor. So in other words, so how do you think Zerach felt about this as he was growing up? You know, I really should have been the firstborn. But Epis, my brother, Chap Miois, he jumped ahead and busted through. So the Zerach and their descendants probably harbored a certain grudge against the other people of against the descendants of Peretz, and probably against the Jewish people in general. And a presumptuous Peretz comes along and he breaches the norms of childbirth and jumps out at his brother, robs him of the kingship. So finally one descendant acts on that grievance, and that's Achan. And it's not necessarily, you know, in other words, he comes to Yehuda's defense, but even not in defense of Yehuda. In other words, he said, who's your shuddah to be the leadership? It should be in Yehuda, and not from Yehuda. But if you really go from Yehuda, it shouldn't be from you. It should be from somebody from the other side, from Peretz. Right? So, and that's why when he is taken out to being executed, as we're going to see shortly, finally, when it talks about him then, it says, it just says, Yeshua, he took out his Achan ben Zerach. He's not really a son of Zerach. He's a son of the other people until he finally gets a great-grandson of Zerach. But so that's really the point, is he wanted to act as the one who felt he should be the leader. It's interesting when the birth of Peretz and Zerach happens, if you look over there, the Medrash notes that the word yad, hand, which says he stuck out his hand, it's mentioned four times in depicting the birth of Zerach. It says the word yad four times. So the Medrash says four times, corresponding to the four times that Achan stole, four times, or the four objects that Achan stole over here, foreshadowing that this was going to happen. And so what's the connection? Now you see the connection. First of all, what's going on? So four times it says hand, four times he steals. Okay, hand steals, yeah, but that's the whole idea, because since the hand was out, he was hoping they'd be the Bechor, but didn't become the Bechor, so there's a descendant who wants to legitimize that birthright. And therefore, by taking, legitimize that birthright. And that's why it mentioned four times. So this was a very dangerous, thing that he did to try to undermine the leadership of Yehoshua. Now, and this is totally, totally not a Jewish concept. Democracy and all these ideas that everybody can decide things this is not the way we're going to go into Eretz Yisrael. Where this is in the very early stages, democracy, everyone who says you're the leader, all these guys, you know, it just can't be brought. And therefore we will see that the way he's killed has to serve a great lesson to everybody over here. So let's proceed and finish up the parak over here. We're on Pasuk Chaf Beis. Okay, so after he finally confesses, we're on Pasuk Chaf Beis. Vayishlach Yeshua Malachim. Yeshua sends messengers. Vayarutzo Ela. They run to his tent. Why have to run to his tent? So the Gemara says, because they were afraid that maybe other people from Yehuda would get rid of the evidence. right? If they at least get the evidence quickly, you know, it'll be fine. And guess, the loot was hidden in his tent. And the silver was underneath. It was all there. And they take it all out from the tent. And they bring it to Yeshua to all the Jewish people. And they kind of pour it out before Hashem, like in front of everybody. And Chazal bring over here and says, and Yeshua says, Hashem, for this, people had to die. And everyone's, look what it amounts to. It's petty narishkeit. Such just little value things. So Chavdal says, Vayikach Yeshua's Ochan ben Zerach. He takes Ochan the son of Zerach, Vesa Kesa, Vesa Deris, Veslashon Azov, Vesbonav, Vesbonaisav, Veshur, Veschamor, Veson, Vesolav, Veskola Shalo. He takes the loot that he took. He also took his sons and daughters and all his other wealth, his oxen, his donkeys, the sheep, his tent, everything. And V'chol Yisraelim, took all the Jews. V'yalu osam emek ochor. And they took them to the valley of Ochor. Ochor means like of dirt, of filth. Because that's what Achan did. He dirtied the name of the Jewish people. V'yomri Yeshua, and Yeshua says, me'achar tanu. Ya'korcha Hashem v'yom hazeh. Just like you have dirtied up the Jewish people. You've dirtied us up. Hashem should dirty you up, as it were. In other words, you gave us all kinds of problems. So Hashem should give you some problems now, and you should be put to death. Vayirgamu osol kol Yisrael, and all the Jewish people stoned him to death. Evan. Vayisrafu osam ba'esh, and then they burnt all the other things up in fire. Vayisklu osam ba'esh, and they stoned them all as well. They had to get rid of this all, and this had to be something that was done in front of the entire Jewish people. It was, his children had to see it. His children had to know how terrible this was. The Jewish people had to see how terrible this was. And this cannot exist. And it had to have the most severe punishment. Now, what gave him the right to kill him? There were no witnesses. But this is what we call a horasha. This was an emergency measure. If he would get off the hook and be allowed to live, then it would be a poison that would spread throughout the Jewish people. And therefore, Vayakimu olav galav onim gadol, they set up on him a big pile of stones. A big one. Adayom hazeh, until this day. Until the day of the writing of the Sefer. And then, Vayoshev Hashem echarnapo. Then Hashem's anger went away from the Jewish people. Al kein kara shema makom ahu. Therefore, they called this name Emek Ochor. The valley of dirt. Adayom hazeh, until this day. Emek Ochor. But finally he was able to admit what he said. Okay, there's a little bit more to add. So, we're not totally finished, but there's a couple more points. So Mirtz Hashem, when we resume on Monday, we'll finish up this topic and then move on to Perek Ches, where the Jews go for the second round against the city of Ai, and then they are successful in defeating Ai.